This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices All-Stars episode number 12 was recorded on June 3rd, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. Professor Steve Keen joins me for today's All-Star interview. And Steve, I've been dying to ask you about something because you are so good at debunking people that tell a good story but have logical holes in it. There's a guy called William Nordhaus who claims to have basically done an economic analysis of climate change, modeled it, got a Nobel Prize for it. Is this real science, or is this another case of a scientist who has strong political views, and certainly most people have strong political views about climate change, who is fitting the science to his own politics? And I don't know. I know you're the guy to ask whether or not something like this is real. What's going on here?
I mean, I have occasionally had held my head in my hands. I've even ended up crying as I've read this stuff because, you know, as you said, I'm somebody who debunks mainstream thought and I pull apart the assumptions and says, so I can take myself right back to 1991. When I first ended up not debunking, but seeing a conventional piece of economics debunked by one of my lecturers and then going and checking, seeing sure enough he was right. So I've been doing this for pretty close to 50 years now. I have never seen anything as bad as Nordhaus's work.
Wow, that's a strong statement, Steve. I wasn't expecting that.
So this guy, if he was crossing the road, I'd hop in the nearest car and aim for him, frankly. I really would. I think he's going to end up killing far more people. His work is set us up for a classic catastrophe beyond anything even I thought was feasible.
Okay, so those are some very, very strong statements. Let's hear some actual substantive backup for why you think those things.
I'll start with the Nobel Prize winning speech, the speech that Nordhaus gave as a result of getting the Nobel Prize. And I'll start with, I think it's slide number 6 in his presentation. People can find this just by searching on the web. Temperature trajectories in different policies. Now, there's a number of lines on the graph, but the one that he dashes is optimal. Yeah, it's an orange line. And what it's showing is temperature levels now compared to what they were before global warming began. So the starting point is in 2010-25, which is at about 3/4 of a degree above pre-industrial levels. And then you extrapolate about 6 lines forward. One of them is called optimal. And that reaches its peak, and then the temperature then stabilizes, at 4 degrees above pre-industrial levels by 2140. So that's what he says that the optimal. Now, what he means by optimal is it's the temperature change that best balances the costs of preventing global warming or attenuating it compared to what it would be without policy versus the benefits of doing it. So he says the costs and benefits max out at about 4, letting 4 degrees of warming occur and doing what's necessary to attenuate it. Whereas if we don't do any attenuation at the same time, he has temperature being 5.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels and still rising. So that's his ideal. Now, I looked at it and thought, how on earth does somebody say that a temperature level 4 degrees above pre-industrial is optimal? What sort of damages is he saying we're talking about? Now, most people, what I expected to find, and this is why I was so shocked what I actually found, is I thought what was going on here was what I've seen a lot of complaints. It applies a very high discount rate to future damages. So the sort of discount rate you might apply if you're working out whether you should invest your money in project X versus project Y, you might put where X has very different time trajectories of the returns. You might put a 5% rate of time discount on them both, and therefore project X, which brings you tremendous benefits in the far future, doesn't really look as good as project Y, which brings smaller benefits in the future but high ones now. That sort of judgment. It turned out it had absolutely nothing to do with discounting. And this is the next stage where you've got to go into the manual for his computer program that he calls the Integrated Climate and Economics Model. On that damages thing, he shows that damages to GDP from a 5-degree increase over pre-industrial levels will it be equivalent to 5% of GDP? And I looked at this, 5 degrees higher than current average global temperatures will only reduce GDP by 5%. How on earth did he get it? And so, and then I looked, there was no discounting. This is, he said the impact of increasing, like if you could increase it instantly, they said that, okay, that increase in temperature today would cause a 5% fall in GDP. What is going on? How on earth was this worked out? And it turns out there are two parts to it. One, what he calls his damage function, which you'd think if you're looking at the impact of changing temperature on the economy, it'd be a pretty complicated function. Have you ever done grade 7 mathematics? That's when you handle quadratics, isn't it? Grade 7, grade 8. His damage function is x squared. Literally, that's it. The damage he postulates from climate change on the economy is simply the difference between pre-industrial temperatures and whatever temperature he's looking at squared. So he says if there's a 1 degree increase in temperature, that causes, you know, let's say x amount of damage. If it's 2, then it's 4x. If it's 3, then it's 9x. If it's 6, then it's 36x, where x comes down to what the coefficient is. Now, this is incredibly simplistic. How did he justify using a quadratic function? That was my first question. How did he justify it? Okay, he lied. He lied. And I want to quote the lie to you. He claims that he says the current version, describing his damage function, the current version assumes that damages are a quadratic function of temperature change and does not include sharp thresholds or tipping points. But this is consistent with a survey by Linton et al. 2008. Now, I want you to keep that in your mind. I'm now going to quote from Linton in a paper called Tipping Elements in the Earth's Climate Systems. This is the conclusion. Society may be lulled into a false sense of security by smooth projections of global change. Our synthesis of present knowledge suggests that a variety of tipping elements could reach their critical points within this century under anthropogenic climate change. In other words, the conclusion of Linton's paper is the exact opposite of what Nordhaus claimed. Now, I could explain, you know, what he actually did to reach this. I think he saw one sentence that suited his opinion and kept on going. But literally, if you put these two statements side by side, and I'm doing that, of course, in a book I'm working on now, it's a lie. The current version, damage is a quadratic, which means smooth, okay, does not include sharpening thresholds or tipping points. You read what he's quoting, you'll get a false sense of security from smooth projections, and there are tipping points. So in technical terms that a 7-year-old would understand or a grade 7 student, that's a lie. So that's the first part of it.
Okay, hang on a second, Steve. If Nordhaus is that far off, why wouldn't you just develop your own model? You've certainly done that in other cases in economics when somebody else's model didn't suit your fancy.
Yeah, well, this is actually where I began, because I've been thinking about the role of energy in economics for decades, because economic theory, and this is not just a critique of the mainstream neoclassicals, by the way, it's a critique of the post-Keynesian school of thought as well. None of them include the role of energy. So I've been saying, look, this is just crazy. We can't have models of production that imagine you can make anything without using energy as an input, because that's literally defying the laws of thermodynamics. So nothing can be made without energy. I finally solved the problem of how do you bring energy into production in an incredibly simple way by the insight that, quote unquote, labor without energy is a corpse, machinery without energy is a sculpture. In other words, you can't work and a machine can't turn unless energy is being supplied. And once I did that, the mathematics dropped out really easily. And it turns out that what production and GDP really are is turning available energy that we just find in the universe, because that's how you get it. You can't make energy, converting that into useful work. And then so on that basis, I had an alternative model. I've had a set of paper published on it with the Journal of Ecological Economics. And I'm now working with a bunch of mathematicians to develop models of production for economists that use energy in an integral way using this insight. So I started doing that. And then as part of generalizing, I thought, well, I better see how I fit into the current literature. Let's take a look at Nordhaus. And then I went looking in deep and I found stuff which has just left me absolutely flabbergasted.
Okay, hang on a second, Steve, because the integration of the importance of energy in the economy, boy, you couldn't get anybody cheering harder than I am for you right now, because I couldn't possibly agree more about how important that is. And you're right, neoclassical models totally don't measure. But hang on a second. energy in the economy, and to my thinking, has everything to do with where we're going to get the needed energy from and so forth. Now, climate science is really, to my thinking, a completely different animal. There's a question, first of all, about whether or not warming is anthropogenically caused, and second, about whether these tipping points are really going to cause acceleration of problems, or if actually there are corrective feedback loops that are going to come into play in order to temper those problems. I don't see how you get from modeling the role of energy in the economy to validating whether or not somebody's climate change model is based on real science or phony science. Those seem like apples and oranges to me. What am I missing?
Well, they are. You're not missing anything. I mean, what I'm saying is in starting to develop models where energy plays a fundamental role, that does actually give you a link with climate change very directly, because if you use energy, you must generate waste. Second law of thermodynamics. Okay? And there's no way to avoid waste unless you can find a part of the universe which is at absolute zero where you can dump the energy you don't, the waste energy you generated. There is no such place, so you've got to have waste. So that gives you a link between having a sensible model for energy, gives you a link between economics and the ecology at a very fundamental level. And that's what I'm working on. But the Nordhaus stuff was just quite separate. I wanted to see what he'd done in detail now that I can myself dive into this area. What am I going to find amongst the neoclassicals now that I'm diving in, you know, the cat amongst the pigeons? What are the pigeons doing? And these pigeons have set us up for a catastrophe that I don't think we're going to avoid. And part of it was that lie about what climate scientists actually concluded about tipping points. And back to the point about anthropogenic change or not, this is just a question of, regardless of how it happens, what happens to the planet if temperature rises by X degrees? Now, it could well be the sun's getting hotter. You know, I accept the climate scientists work on CO2 and greenhouse gases, but even if I didn't, and I said it's all due to the sun, these are Nordhaus's prediction, what would happen to the sun got 2 degrees warmer or 5 degrees warmer and so on. And so if you can leave aside whether you accept carbon, the anthropogenic climate change argument or not, to say how realistic are his models about the impact of temperature changes on GDP.
Okay, so you think that his projections are insufficiently discounting how big of a deal climate change is going to be. But my question to that would be, well, wait a minute, does this guy have any influence? Okay, I get that he's getting a Nobel Prize. That's a big deal. Does he affect policy directly? What is his role in this whole process? And I mean, you're using some pretty darn strong language here, Steve, saying he is dangerous. So if you're saying he's dangerous to society, which I think you're saying, that's an awfully strong statement. What's he going to do that is going to endanger anyone?
It's what he's already done. Because he and people like Toll, who works with him, and a whole range of other researchers, there's only about 20 of them, it's less than 20 people, you could fit them in a seminar room, they have commandeered the economic side of the IPCC, the International Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They write the economic stuff. And he doesn't actually directly write it, but he's quoted. You remember the old Blues Brothers movie line when they look up and look, and where the Nazis are after them, and they notice that the Blues Brothers are a rash through the police database. Nordhaus is like a rash through the IPCC, and he's not. I'm reading the 1995 report right now. I'm going through them all as we speak. But say 1995, he's not one of the authors, but his side effects, Toll, Funkhauser and a few others are actual authors of the reports. And the numbers that Nordhaus is claiming about the impact of climate change are part of the IPCC. And this is what politicians are seeing. And they're looking at it and saying, oh, a 5 degree increase in temperature will only reduce GDP by 5%. Why should I bother?
Okay. How do we translate this for significance to investors? If you're right, and this guy who has a lot of influence is, in your opinion, giving bad advice to people who are taking his advice, that's going to set up some kind of imbalance or impricing of something. What gets impriced? Where's the trade?
Oh, the trade is fundamentally with the energy stocks, and particularly carbon-based ones, of course, essentially coal, but also oil. And this relates to the second problem I need to clarify before we finish talking about the marketing side of things. Why is he so wrong? Because what they have assumed is that the increase in temperature that's going to come from global warming, and again, even if you don't believe it's anthropogenic, that increase in temperature over time can be estimated by looking at the difference in GDP over space today. In other words, if Dallas has a 10% lower GDP per head than Washington, and there's a 10-degree temperature between the two, that can be extrapolated to say what's going to happen to global GDP if temperature rises by 10 degrees. Now, I hope you can see the nonsense in that straight away, because if you're comparing GDP in Dallas to GDP in Washington today, there's no change in energy in the global biosphere between those two comparisons. Yes, it might be that Dallas is slightly poorer per head than Washington, but there's no change in the global energy level. That's what's being ignored by this study. So what they've done is they've done regressions on current distribution of income and distribution of temperature across America, and they've extrapolated that what's going to happen from global warming. So what they come up with, and this is one of my favorite studies, a guy called Mendelsohn, who's one of Nordhaus's colleagues. They work at the same university. He predicted that a 2.5-degree increase in global temperature would increase GDP by 1%, not decrease, increase, because most of the GDP in the world is generated in countries that are below 12 degrees Celsius average temperature. And by making them slightly warmer, you'll get an increase in GDP. Just because they're applying these regressions for differences between places now and extrapolating those forward, which ignores what actually is about global warming. It's containing more energy in the atmosphere. And the amount of energy that's being ignored in this particular case, I've just done a little back of the envelope calculation, is equivalent to exploding 2 atom bombs per person on the planet. 12 billion Hiroshima bombs are the difference between 1 degree and 2.5 degrees in terms of the temperature rise of the atmosphere. And that's being ignored in the regressions they're doing. So their data is nonsense and the model is nonsense. People's confidence about coal and so on being able to go for the future will start falling apart as soon as we start to approach something like a 2-degree temperature increase. And on current trajectory, we're going to get there by 2045, 2050. So it's a very painful and very scary short, but fundamentally, at some point, we're going to be told, shut down those power stations, shut down anything using oil. There's a massive overvaluation. If this is what policymakers are taking seriously, and frankly, they are, because that's all they look at, the GDP figures, they don't worry about the other stuff, they're going to be massively underestimating the impact of climate change. Anything reliant upon coal, at some point when their projections become completely wrong, there's going to be a huge short.
So you think the short on energy comes when energy is outlawed, effectively?
At some point,
is
yeah.
The gist of it? Okay, but what's the replacement, Steve? I would contend that it is impossible to operate the economy without energy. If you're going to stop burning fossil fuels, you've got to propose an alternative before you can shut anything down or outlaw anything. What is it if it's not fossil fuels?
Frankly, I think it's going to be rationing. Again, in terms of fuels, the more I look at this, the more it appears that renewables aren't up to the job. I've got quite a few friends in physics and atmospheric science who are saying that the energy return and energy invested in renewables is not high enough. The amount of land you'd need to devote to it is too high because there's such low density energy compared to what we're used to. Other people are working on thorium. I think if there's any positive news out this, then it's say, take a look at anybody working on thorium reactors, because they do have the dense energy levels. I've seen disputes in both directions, but from what I can, my own reading of the literature is that it doesn't handle the proliferation problem at all, but it does handle the waste problem potentially. So I'd say something in the area of thorium research is something that I would be backing had I cash to throw at the game, but not renewables. So I think renewables look like it's, you know, that's another shorting opportunity in some ways. They won't reach the promise people have got for them. Thorium might well, but overall, this is implying that we're not going to solve the problem by carbon taxes, which is the way that Nordhaus has pushed policy. At some point, there's going to have to be a dramatic change, and it would mean literally outlawing. And if that means a fall in GDP, it means a fall in GDP.
Wow. Well, I couldn't disagree with you more on some aspects of this. We're going to have to save that debate for another interview. But at the same time, I agree dramatically on others. And by the way, I think that thorium does solve the proliferation problem. We could get into that in another discussion. But before I let you go, I've got one last question, which is, I know from my experience of applying patterns and knowing lag times in investing, that anytime Professor Steve Keen gets himself this worked up over something, there's usually a book coming within 6 to 12 months. Am I right?
Yes, that's true. I mean, and I'm aiming to get one out before the next Nobel Prize award, because I think if anything points out how illegitimate the so-called Nobel Prize in economics is, it's awarding it to Nordhaus.
Okay. Well, we will look forward to news about the book when there's a book forthcoming. In the meantime, we're going to have to let you go. But before we do, tell our listeners how they can follow your work on Patreon and read more about all the exciting things that you're researching.
Thank you. Well, it's on www.patreon.com/ProfSteveKeen, and sign up there is as little as $1 a month. I've got about 400 or 500 people doing that. $10 a month gets you my podcast. More than that is you being generous and me being very slow in supplying the books that I'm promising to hand out to people as the thank you. But yeah, through Patreon. And again, what I'm doing is, in anybody in Patreon gets to see the stuff that I'm working on before it gets published. And that includes this work on Nordhaus.
Fantastic. Well, we look forward to getting you back on for another update in a couple of weeks, Steve. Meanwhile, listeners, you've got Julian Brigden and Jeff Snyder on deck for All-Stars appearances this week. And we've also got Anas Alhaji, Art Berman, and Tracy Shuchart on energy. And of course, Thursday night, we've got our regular Macro Voices podcast. So we look forward to seeing you for all of our exciting content. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.